Lebanon and to stop future attacks and geopolitical war in the region is that leaders in Europe and leaders in North America, particularly the United States, put their leg down and say enough is enough and threaten Israel that if there is no ceasefire, they will sanction Israel. They will stop arms trade with Israel. They'll stop sending Israel money and ultimately stop trading with Israel. So our belief is to save the populations that inhabit this region, we need such an action.
Can you talk directly about what's happening in the United States? Clearly, the major arms supplier to Israel, and what you think of the role of the Biden administration, of President Biden himself?
The United States has a memorandum for arms trade, and in that memorandum for arms trade, it says very clearly that countries or warring parties that violate international humanitarian law and the laws of war, the U.S. will not sell weapons to them, will not give them weapons or sell weapons to them. It is beyond doubt that Israel has been systematically violating the laws of war since October 7th, 8th, and yet the United States continues to send arms, and that has to do with many reasons. One is what is the power of the military corporations in the United States. The other is the lobbying groups in the United States. And all the United States really has to do, all Kamala Harris has to do today, is say that the minute I'm president, if there is violation of international law, I will stop sending arms. And yet the United States is breaking its own laws in order to continue giving Israel arms so that it continues its violence in Gaza, Lebanon, and elsewhere.
And your response to the grassroots protests across the country of the Biden administration continuing to support Israel?
There's a major gap both in the United States but all across Europe and North America between civil society and the political and financial elites. The civil society has been saying now for over a year, enough, we want ceasefire, we're against this human catastrophe, we're against what Israel's doing to the Palestinian people, we want the Palestinian people to enjoy self-determination, to enjoy statehood like everyone else. And yet the political and financial elites are continuing as if nothing is happening, supporting Israel. Here and there, there's a kind of criticism from Biden. And yet Netanyahu is doing exactly as he wants to do. And the Biden administration is not doing anything. And there's fear from donors here during an election campaign. It's a very complex system, but what we see is this major gap between the two kind of poles, the civil society pole on the one hand and the ruling political and financial elites. And I think we just need to continue doing what we do until we get them to follow their own laws as they appear, for example, in the Memorandum of Arms Trade.
Professor Gordon, does Netanyahu have a plan for Gaza? And what about these negotiations that are now taking place in Doha, in Qatar? Apparently, Egypt has proposed a two-day ceasefire, release of four hostages. What is happening there, and what do you think needs to happen?
Well, I'd like to say a few words about the bigger picture. I think Netanyahu, pre-October 7th, 2023, saw himself as a figure of history, one that has led Israel to economic success, one that will normalize relations with Arab countries in the region, including Saudi Arabia, and one that has slowly managing to erase the Palestinians from history. Come October 7th and the failure of the Israeli intelligence, and after 35 weeks of the protest against the judicial overhaul, and the death of 1,200 Israelis and 250 Israeli hostages, he understood that his position in history has changed, and he's trying to rebuild that through, I think, three axes. One is the Gaza Strip, and I have very little belief in the current negotiations. I think large parts of his coalition want to resettle the northern Gaza Strip, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing there and what your previous guest told us about, the kind of displacement of the population there, the destruction of the whole infrastructure of existence of the population through the destruction of the hospitals, of the schools, of the mosques, etc. And ultimately, what Netanyahu's coalition would like is to resettle that part of the Gaza Strip and close the rest of the Palestinians in the south, and probably maintain some kind of ethnic policing there for years to come. In Lebanon, I think Netanyahu would like to cleanse the area that's south of the Litani River from any presence of Hezbollah, and I think that's going to last for quite a while now. I hope I'm wrong, but I think that it's not going to end soon. But I think that the crown of the jewel for Netanyahu, and the only way that he thinks of himself as returning to history as a hero, is through the bombing of the nuclear plants in Iran. I think everything is leading in that direction. Again, I hope I'm wrong, but I think now Netanyahu will wait for the elections on November 5th, and then he'll decide how to continue on that strategy. So I think the talks now in Doha are more of a cosmetic to a large process that we see unfolding now in Israel and the Middle East.
Professor Gordon, we just have a minute, but you begin your recent Al Jazeera piece headlined, "Israel's taken human shields to a whole new criminal level," writing, quote, "The use of human shields in war is not a new phenomenon. Militaries have forced civilians to serve as human shields for centuries. Yet despite this long and dubious history, Israel's managed to introduce a new form of shielding in Gaza, one that appears unprecedented in the history of warfare." We have 1 minute, if you could explain.
So human shielding works through a politics of vulnerability, through the recognition that the civilian that is shielding a military target is not like a robust landmine or anti-missile defense system, but it's the moral value that is ascribed to the civilian that supposedly deters the enemy from firing. So if Hamas sees a co-patriot dressed in civilian clothes, then hopefully that will dissuade them from firing and killing the human shield or try to deter it. When you dress the human shield in military garb, you're not trying to deter Hamas from firing at the civilian, but you're trying to actually lure Hamas so that they think it's an Israeli soldier, that they fire at him, and then the Israeli soldiers can see where the fire is coming from and fire back. So it's changing the whole logic of human shielding and using the vulnerability instead of as a form of deterrence in order to lure fire in, and basically relating to the Palestinian civilians not only as not quite human, as any kind of human shielding would relate to him, but actually as fodder, as a thing, as a shield without the human in it.
Niamh Gordon, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli political scientist, professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London. He's one of the main signatories of a letter that has now more than 3,000 signatories of Israelis calling on international pressure on Israel. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged for a return to diplomacy and, quote, maximum efforts to prevent an all-out regional war after Israel bombed Iranian military facilities and air defense systems Saturday. The strikes included a site linked to Iran's ballistic missile program. Iran said four soldiers were killed. Israel also struck air defense batteries and radars in Syria and Iraq. The Iranian president said Iran would take an appropriate response to the attack, but reiterated that Iran does not seek a wider war. Israel's attack came about 4 weeks after Iran launched a missile attack on Israeli military sites in response to Israel's mounting assault on Lebanon and Israel's assassination of Hezbollah and Hamas leaders, the Hamas leader in Tehran, Iran, on Inauguration Day, where the Israelis killed him. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita, thanks so much for joining us for just these few minutes. If you can explain what took place this weekend and where you think Iran and Israel will go next.
Well, what happened over the weekend is the expected Israeli response to the Iranian response to Israel's initial attack earlier on in April that started this whole exchange of fire between the two countries. What we don't know, at least with confidence, is exactly how much damage the Israelis managed to cause in Iran. Clearly, there's been some damage. There's been at least five deaths. But the extent to which Iran's air defenses have been taken out, etc., remains unclear. The Iranians initially played down the attack, signaled that they would not respond because it was not a significant attack. But the debate inside of Iran seems to be shifting on that issue precisely because of the deaths that has been caused by the Israelis. The question the Iranians have is not only what options do they have that would avoid further escalation, but also how would it impact the American elections? Are they better off responding before or after the Iranian elections? Is there a way for them to avoid responding at all? Or would a lack of a response only further increase Israel's appetite for striking Iran increasingly with impunity if the Iranians are not striking back?
So I wanted to ask you about Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris's response to Israel's attack on Iran. She said she'd like to see de-escalation in the region, but added, quote, "I feel very strongly, we as the United States feel very strongly that Iran must stop what it's doing in terms of the threat that it presents to the region. And we will always defend Israel against any attacks by Iran in that way." Your response?
Well, it is exactly this type of approach that has led us to this level of escalation. On the one hand, saying that we don't want to see escalation. On the other hand, providing the Israelis with every equipment, every bomb, every piece of intelligence that allows them to escalate, then offering them protection against any Iranian retaliation, which then reduces the cost of escalation for the Israelis. And lo and behold, here we are. The Israelis are just continuously escalating the situation, striking more and more. They're now striking five or six countries in the Middle East. And all the United States says is that we would not like to see escalation, but we are providing every opportunity and every equipment and every logistical piece of material in order for the Israelis to have an easier time escalating the situation.
And your response to the Washington Post report that the Biden administration won assurances from Israel that Israel will not strike Iranian nuclear or oil sites in any retaliatory act. Do you agree with what our previous guest, the Israeli professor Niamh Gordon, said, that he is concerned that that's just where Israel is headed, perhaps waiting for Election Day next week, and then would do something like that after?
Absolutely. The signals coming out of Israel, the signals coming out of those in Washington who want Israel to go further, is to essentially say, see, it was relatively easy to strike Iran. What are we waiting for? Let's go all the way. And moreover, as I said on this show before, just because the first response at this time now was not going after the nuclear sites, because we are on an escalatory cycle, does not then mean that we will not end up would strike against the nuclear sites in a full-scale war that would prompt. So the point is, it's not where the first step is. It's where this is leading to that is important. And this, unfortunately, is leading, much thanks to the approach of the Biden administration, towards a much larger escalation.
So finally, Trita Parsi, you are the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. What do you feel would be responsible statecraft right now?
Right now, the most responsible thing the United States could do that would also lie in the U.S.'s own interests is to actually pursue a strategy that truly de-escalates the situation. Such a strategy would put pressure on all of the different parties, including, of course, the Iranians and the Houthis and Hezbollah, but it would also put pressure on Israel, and it would deprive Israel from all of the American bombs and all of the American material that the Biden administration has given them that allows them to just continue this war and to escalate this war. This is not terribly difficult to de-escalate if we actually pursue a strategy that is aimed at de-escalation.
Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. When we come back, President Biden apologizes for government-run Native American boarding schools that sought to exterminate indigenous culture. Back in 20 seconds. Improvisation 3, an E for Two Flutes by R. Carlos Nakai, a Native American flutist of Navajo and Ute heritage. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's formally apologized for government-run Native American boarding schools, which separated indigenous families and sought to exterminate indigenous culture. He's the first U.S. president to ever do so. Biden issued the apology Friday while visiting the Gila River Indian community in Arizona, where Democrats are vying for the support of Native communities, a crucial voting bloc that could swing the results of next week's election. This was Biden's first diplomatic visit to a tribal nation in his four-year term. He spoke for a few seconds before he was interrupted by an indigenous protester.
The federal Indian boarding school policy, the pain it has caused, will always be a significant mark of shame, a blot on American history. For too long, this all happened with virtually no public attention, not written about in our history books.
No, what about the people in Gaza?
Not taught in our schools. Letter talk. Oh, no, let her go. There's a lot of innocent people being killed. And it has to stop.
The U.S. government operated hundreds of boarding schools from 1819 to 1969, where children reported horrific physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. An Interior Department investigation this year found nearly 1,000 indigenous children died while at these schools. Biden was joined Friday by Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first ever Native American cabinet secretary member of the Pueblo of Laguna, whose grandparents were forced to attend boarding schools.
Tens of thousands of indigenous children as young as 4 years old were taken from their families and communities and forced into boarding schools run by the U.S. government and religious institutions. These federal Indian boarding schools have impacted every indigenous person I know. Some are survivors, some are descendants, but we all carry the trauma that these policies and these places inflicted.
That's Deb Haaland and President Biden speaking at the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona. For more, we go to Raleigh, North Carolina, where we're joined by Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of the Indigenous-led NDN Collective. Nick, thanks so much for joining us again on Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of this apology, the first American president to do so, and what you are calling for?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is one of the most historic moments in the history of this country in its relationship with Indian people. And to be clear, this moment was really created and led by the leadership of Secretary Deb Haaland and her team there at the Department of Interior. And what this has meant and means for Indian country is that we hope that this is a beginning of an era of repair. Repair between the United States government and the indigenous people, the first people of this land. And as monumental as this apology is, we have to embrace the complexity of this moment. We have to embrace the complexity of this moment and lean towards action, too, because it can't be an apology that's on empty words. And they've been making great strides, at the Department of Interior by investing into indigenous education and by investing into research to further know and understand what has happened, with the Indian boarding schools. But we need more of that. And so some of the things that we're calling on is there's a few things that President Biden can do before he leaves office to follow up on this. One of those calls to action is rescinding the medals of honor that were given to the 7th Cavalry at the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890. To rescind those medals of honor would be a way to invoke healing. The other thing that we're calling upon is, America's longest living indigenous political prisoner in American history is a boarding school survivor, and his name is Leonard Peltier. And so we're calling upon President Biden to for executive clemency for Leonard Peltier. We also want to see this administration and actually future administrations invest into unprecedented levels of investing into indigenous language, culture, and education, because it was the education that was weaponized and used as a mechanism to assimilate our people. And as a result of that, so many indigenous languages were lost. And so now we're calling upon Biden to invest into unprecedented levels of indigenous education and languages. And then lastly, what we want to see Congress do is we want to see Congress pass the U.S. Truth and Healing Commission bill, because that bill would make sure that the truth and healing work that is currently underway can be supported for the long haul, far into the future, because it's not one apology that can fix this. This is hopefully the beginning of a new era of repair and healing between indigenous people and the United States government.
So on the issue of Leonard Peltier, there is also another incredible connection, because Leonard Peltier was a survivor of the residential boarding schools, wasn't he, Nick?
Absolutely. He was in the boarding schools, and he was in the Sisseton Wahpeton boarding school.
In North Dakota?
South Dakota. And so he was in that boarding school, taken from his home. And what a lot of people don't realize is that Leonard Peltier and many people who became leaders in the American Indian Movement were survivors of boarding school. They came out of that era, and then they resisted. And so Leonard Peltier is part of that resistance. And so it's an incredibly reflective thing to think about, that America's longest living indigenous political prisoner, who's incarcerated right now at the age of 80 years old in maximum security prison, is actually a boarding school survivor. And so that's why,
imprisoned in Florida. I remember asking President Clinton on Election Day 2000 if he would consider granting clemency for Leonard Peltier, which he said he was weighing at the time. That was almost a quarter of a century ago.
Mm. Yeah, that was almost, I mean, and here we are now, you know, and so we're continuing to push. We'd like to see, executive clemency for Leonard Peltier. And I think that one of the ways that this can happen is that Biden can give executive clemency to Leonard Peltier by humanizing him and recognizing Leonard Peltier is a survivor of boarding schools. And he just apologized for the impact of boarding schools. And the freedom that Leonard Peltier was fighting for was to break free of those things that happened by the impact of boarding schools on Native communities and Indigenous communities. And so this is a profound opportunity. And it's a way for President Biden to take action, you know, in a huge issue that would impact throughout Indian country.
Nick, before we go, I want to ask you about the Native American vote in this country. The apology was made in Arizona. You have a very close race in Montana between Tim Sheehy and Senator Tester. The role of the Native American vote, not only there, but in this country.
Well, the Native American vote has the ability to swing this election in key swing states. And so Native American vote does matter and has the ability to impact this election. What we want to see is we want to see more action. If the Democrats want the vote of Indian people, we want them to stand with us, not only on issues like the apology around boarding schools, but we also want them to stand with us in the solidarity that we have calling for a ceasefire in Palestine. And both of those things are true to us, and they don't automatically get our vote. The Democrats don't automatically get the vote of Native people. They must stand with us. And we stand in deep solidarity with the Palestinian people for freedom, for justice, and for liberation, and we call for a ceasefire. And so what we want is the progressives to stand with Indian people. And that's how you earn an Indian vote.
Finally, Nick Tilson, what would you demand of a President Trump if he is elected president and a President Harris?
Both of them. One, this apology that was made on behalf of the United States government. So our expectation is that whoever is the president, Harris or Trump, that they have absolutely and equivocally, they have to follow through on commitments that they've made for truth, healing, and reconciliation. Secondly, we want to see a ceasefire now. As people who have survived the American genocide, we want to stop the genocide of the Palestinian people. We want to work towards a more peaceful movement in the world. And we want to continue to fight for the return of indigenous lands back into indigenous hands. And these are demands to both of these administrations because this entire democracy is built on the stolen lands of indigenous people. So this is what we're calling for at this time in history. You know, unprecedented levels of investment into indigenous languages, the return of indigenous lands back into indigenous hands, and a ceasefire.
Nick Tilson, I want to thank you so much for being with us, founder and CEO of the Indigenous-led NDN Collective, a member of the Oglala Lakota Nation. He's speaking to us at a conference from Raleigh, North Carolina. And tune in on election night to Democracy Now!, Tuesday, November 5th, for a four-hour election special, War, Peace, and the Presidency. Join us from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time. We'll also be airing an expanded two-hour election show on Wednesday, November 6th, from 8 to 10 Eastern Time in the morning. Any station, radio or television, can take these broadcasts as well. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowship programs. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sherifa Bdokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Start wagging your tail. Fun Drive is here. I am Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, host of the Salute Our Show. Join CJSF and all your favorite hosts as we show the world how you really are truly radio's best friend. Donate now at cjsffundrive.ca or text the word DONATE to 778-782-2573.